It's a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on his teachings, passing on the teachings of all the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. I'd like to start by giving you some context. Suzuki Roshi gave these talks on the Sandokai, a poem. It's a poem by Sekito Kisen, S-E-K-I-T-O, Sekito Kisen. He gave these talks at Tassajara in very hot, over 100 degree weather in the evening. And during the day, he worked dragging stones from the stream, Tassajara Creek, to build up the side of the creek so to prevent erosion. And at night, he lectured. But he was sick. And his wife, Mitsu-san, would come down from San Francisco, and she thought he was working too hard. But his assistant at the time, Mel Weissman, who worked at the creek with him, tells us that sometimes she'd pass by and he'd pretend to be resting. And then as soon as she was gone, he'd go back and work on the creek. And once she chastised him, Hojo-san, you know, you are cutting your life short. And he'd say, if I don't cut my life short, my students will not grow. So Roshi was never in a hurry. After spending all day putting one large stone just where it would go on the creek side, if it wasn't right, he'd take it out and he'd start all over the next day. And he said, you have a saying to kill two birds with one stone, but our way is to kill one bird with one stone. He always gave the feeling of being completely one with whatever activity he was in the moment. A talk is more of an informative presentation than a teisho, which offers the teacher's own dharma, his own direct understanding. So a Soto teacher's talk often mixes the two, and it's both informative and expressing his own understanding. And during the talks, the students at Tassajara sat in Zazen posture, and during Sesshin, Roshi spoke every night, and sometimes, he spoke every day and sometimes twice a day. Roshi was in the lineage stream of Zen Master Dogen, who's 1200 to 1253. That's when Dogen lived. And he was committed to introducing Dogen's way to the West. Like Dogen, he didn't consider Zen a teaching separate from the Buddha Dharma. Dharma is just teaching. And so Buddha Dharma is the teaching of the Buddha. So Suzuki Roshi and Dogen didn't consider this teaching anything separate from Buddha's teaching. They didn't consider their school inferior or superior to any other schools. Roshi characterized our way as a Hinayana practice with Mahayana mind. Hinayana is considered the narrow vehicle and Mahayana is the wide vehicle. That means Hinayana practice is for the individual and Mahayana practice is for the benefit of all beings. So in the 60s, Roshi's talk started to be recorded, and some of his Los Altos ones were the basis of the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, whose message is how to let go of our self-centeredness and settle our minds in big mind, Daishin. And as you all know from the first series, Beginner's Mind refers to the unassuming attitude of just being present in each moment with openness and clarity, being available to all possibilities. It's not so easy. The Sandokai represents an entirely different teaching context and different feeling. Roshi is lecturing on an ancient Chinese poem, line by line, word by word, over a six-week period. And the Sandokai is chanted every day in the liturgy at Zen Center, as well as in Japanese Soto Zen monasteries. And at Tassajara, he set up a little blackboard right by his seat, and he wrote out and explained the Chinese characters as he went along. It was this technical. He gave 12 talks plus another one for a group of philosophy students who came by Zen Center, and he gave them by way of a general summary. He also made up phrases of his own, like things as it is, which just kind of stretch our ordinary understanding and way of thinking. And independency is another one of his originals. You might think that interdependent would be the correct word, but Roshi made up independency to express the ambivalent quality between dependent and interdependent. So independency. He said, the secret of Soto Zen is yes, but, meaning that nothing is ever exactly the way it seems. So it's very common in the Dharma, which is the world of Buddhist teachings. And I think it's a great point to think of the Dharma as something we should test. Doubt everything is the motto. Doubt everything. Teachers offer you bits and pieces that they think are important, but it's up to you to decide. And it's really about you and encouraging you to experience what you hear for yourself. The Dharma is most precious when it opens up something inside of you that you've never realized, sort of like Disneyland, only on another level. Roshi died December 4th, 1971, a year and a half after delivering this series of teachings. He was 67, and he might have had a premonition of this because it's said that Zen teachers in the Soto tradition often lecture on the Sandokai toward the end of their lives. The author, Sekito Kisen, in 742, he built a hut on a large stone ledge on Mount Heng in China. His name is Sekito, which means stonehead, and it derives from this sitting zazen on this stone ledge. His actual name is Great Master Shitao, and he was known for sitting continuously without sleeping day or night. The five schools of Zen developed from all five schools of Zen developed from Sekito's teaching and Basso, who lived at the same time, and they sent students to each other. You know, they'd have a student in front of them and, no, that's not really the correct understanding. You should go to my friend Basso. He'll teach you the right way. And that's how they did it. But Soto Zen is known to have a more gentle quality than Rinzai. In Japan, it's called the Elder Brother's Way. The elder brother may not be so able or bright, but he's very gentle. And Soto is sometimes called a very careful and considerate style of finding everything within oneself. So though the poem can be very technical, I'm going to give you a very careful and considerate style of reading it. Though the elder brother may not be so able or bright, he's very gentle. So this is the elder brother's explication. When we sit, it's like something happening in the great sky. Whatever kind of bird flies through it, the sky doesn't care. That is the mind transmitted from Buddha to us. When we sit, it's like something happening in the great sky. Whatever kind of bird flies through it, the sky doesn't care. That is the mind transmitted from Buddha to us. When you do something without any feeling of having done it, then that is you, yourself. Like a bird flying through the sky, you're completely one with everything and you don't feel self-conscious. That is the mind transmitted from Buddha to us. This is self-respect. So what is self-respect? In Buddhism, there's this idea that the self lacks independent self-existence. So the self lacks independent self-existence, that nothing in the world exists by virtue of itself, but instead depends for its existence on the interrelationship with everything else. In this sense, self-respect would be respect for all existence, the entirety of the interconnected universe. Self-respect would be respect for the entirety of the interconnected universe, because that's who we are. When Roshi buys the wilted lettuce instead of the nice fresh head that the proprietor urges on him, because he says he feels sorry for it, that is self-respect. Even though his wife Mitsu-san might not be exactly thrilled when he brings it home. But that's a different story. So to practice our way, we eat this food. To practice our way, we eat this food. This is a line from the meal chant and is how big mind is included in our practice. Big mind includes in its thinking the entirety of the interconnected universe. To think this is just a vegetable is not our understanding. We must treat things as part of ourselves within our practice and within big mind. Actually, because of the interdependent nature of all things, there is no enlightenment outside of delusion. There is no enlightenment outside of delusion. I think I'm just talking for myself now. I think that this is why Roshi so frequently says that we're already enlightened. Just sitting is enlightenment. And I've always wondered, how's that exactly? And I think this is why, because of the interdependent nature of all things, then it makes sense. There's no enlightenment outside of delusion. It's a really important point. Roshi says to practice Zazen is to attain this kind of self-respect. You must be strict with yourself and especially with your tendencies. We each have our own unique personal tendencies, but if you try to get rid of them, or if you try not to think or not to hear the sound of the stream during Zazen, it's not possible. Let your ears hear without trying to hear. Let the mind think without trying to think and without trying to stop it. That's practice. More and more, you will have this rhythm or strength as the power of practice. Roshi says, if you practice hard, you'll be like a child. So we can strive for that. Then he says, while we were talking about self-respect, a bird was singing outside, peep, peep, peep. That's self-respect. But this is Roshi is saying, that's self-respect, peep, peep, peep. It doesn't mean anything. Maybe it was just singing. Maybe without trying to think, it was just singing peep, peep, peep. When we heard it, we couldn't stop smiling. We couldn't say, that is just a bird. It controls the whole mountain, the whole world. That is self-respect. We say that Zen is not something to talk about. It's what you experience in a true sense. But Roshi says he has to say something, otherwise we might get discouraged. And not only that, his teacher said, if you're going to say something, you have to prepare to say something. So he prepares, but he gets distracted. And Roshi was known for being absent-minded. And there's some very funny, although painful, stories of his absent-mindedness. And I want to ask you what you think the difference is between absent-minded, and doing something without any feeling of having done something, like a bird flying through the sky. Think about this. What is the difference between absent-minded and doing something without any feeling of having done something, like a bird flying through the sky? So I have a tentative answer to this question. I invite you to think, all day and night about it, frankly. But the tentative answer, just to kind of get you going, is that absent-minded has a feeling of sneaking out of intentionality. Roshi, by the way, admits to being mischievous. He was very mischievous all his life. But absent-minded has this feeling of sneaking out of intentionality, whereas flying through the sky for a bird has the tremendous force and intentionality of its whole being. That's what I would answer if I would answer that question. When you do something without any feeling of having done something, then that is you yourself. For example, when I say I'm a poet, it's not quite true, and I feel slightly uncomfortable. When I just go to my desk after washing and making tea, I'm just doing what I do without thinking I'm doing it even. It's just me. I don't even think about it. Saying I'm a poet makes me feel that I'm telling other people that I've done something, but actually, when I write from interconnected with all beings, me. So it doesn't feel like I've done anything. I hope that makes sense. Roshi says, things are already going in a very strict way. There is no exception. Whenever there is something, there is some rule or truth behind it that is always strictly controlling it without any exception. We think we care for freedom, but the other side of freedom is strict rule. Within the strict rule, there is complete freedom. Freedom and strict rule are not two separate things. And the rule or truth is the entirety of the interconnected universe. So a student asks, when Roshi says this, a student asks, could you give us more examples that apply to our individual lives? And Roshi said, when you get up, you should just get up. When everyone sleeps, you should sleep. That is my example. So then another student said, and this is absolutely an amazing example. This student said, the other day when I was beating the mokugyo, it's a drum, and it provides the rhythm for all the chanting. So picture the zendo, and all the students in the zendo are chanting together, and the chanting is led by this drum. So the student says, the other day when I was, so one student beats the drum, when I was beating the mokugyo, a small spider crawled across the top of it. There was nothing I could do to avoid the spider. I veered a little off the side to avoid him, but he went right into the striker. It was too powerful for him to escape. So you please picture this, you know, entire zendo of students, and then the person leading it basically is dealing with this spider. And Roshi's answer says, our practice can be very strict practice. You should be ready to kill something, even if you're a Buddhist. Whether it is good or bad, you should do that sometime. It is impossible to survive without killing anything. We cannot live depending just on our feelings. Our practice must be deeper than that. This is the strict side of our practice. On the other hand, if it is absolutely necessary, you should stop hitting the mokugyo, even though it throws everything into confusion. Not so easy. I just think that's an amazing answer. So that's the that's the strict rule. So here are 5 points from what I've just said that I think are important to remember. This one about like a bird flying through the sky, you are completely with everyone and you don't feel self-conscious. And that is the mind transmitted from Buddha to us. And that is self-respect. Like a bird flying through the sky. The sky doesn't care, whatever kind of bird. When you do something without any feeling of having done something, then that is you yourself. To practice our way we eat this food is how big mind is included in our practice. This is just a vegetable, is not our understanding. We treat things as part of ourselves within our practice and within big mind. And the fourth point, things are already going in a very strict way. There is no exception. Whenever there is something, there is some rule or truth behind it that is always strictly controlling it without exception. This is what Roshi firmly says. And strict practice means when the alarm rings, you should get up. When everybody sleeps, you should sleep. That's strict practice. Those five things. And some things to think about during the week or write about in your notebooks. So this thing about things are already going in a very strict way. There is no exception. If you could identify something in your life where you actually feel the rule or truth behind it that's strictly controlling it, what is something in your life that you can feel the strict rule? There is a sense of when everybody sleeps, you should sleep. And when everybody gets up, you should get up. Just da-da-da. There's a sense of that. The second one is when you prepare a meal for yourself and others, how do you describe your state of mind? What is your state of mind when you're cooking and fixing food for yourself and others? And Roshi, the third one is, Roshi said the secret of Soto Zen is yes, but. That is, regarding everything, there's more than one way to look at it. Could you give an example of that from your life? Just about everything? I mean, Roshi really is serious about this. Yes, but. There's always another way to look at things. And this idea of Soto Zen is sometimes called a very careful and considerate style of Zen practice, a way of finding everything within oneself. You know, this is different from koan practice, where you there's a koan and you're thinking about this other thing. So how can it be, this is what I want you to think about, how can it be that the way of, most of us when we're sitting, we're just in pain. So how can it be that the way of Soto Zen is very careful and considerate? How is that? We're sitting and we're just in a lot of pain and we're told that this is the very careful and considerate way. How do you put those two things together? And then finally, when Roshi says, why do you think Roshi says, you should be ready to kill something, even if you're a Buddhist, whether it's good or bad, you should do that sometime. Why is he stressing this point? So that's what I have, and I invite you to think about this talk, and please comment or ask anything that you feel like.
Kirill, so somebody asked a few minutes ago that what is an appropriate approach to cockroaches in my house? I hate them, I kill them, I put poison out to prevent them from coming into my house. but something in your talk today makes me think there is a better way.
I'm sure that other Zen students have other things to say about this, but what I want to say is that we can't live with cockroaches. It's not safe for yourself or anyone else around you, that you really need to kill them. But as you're killing them, you can have a very compassionate heart and bless their way and wish them a better, higher incarnation the next time. I think the mind with which you kill them is what's actually the most important thing. And I'm certainly not saying that if you could find a way to help them move on and live somewhere else, that would be okay too. I remember when I lived, actually it was at the Berkeley Zen Dome at the time, and we would go out in the morning and kind of peel the slugs off of the plants that we had growing there. And we put all the slugs in a bucket and we take them to the ocean or somewhere else where they could, not to drown them in the ocean, but to live somewhere else. So we just pick the slugs off and we take them somewhere else where they could live without eating our vegetables. So that's my answer. I wish I had a better one.
So another one is, could you repeat Roshi's answer to how do you know if it is absolutely necessary to stop beating the drum, to save the spider, or is it better to continue the beat?
He actually presented two things to that student. He said, I'm going to read you his answer. He said, our practice can be very strict practice. You should be ready to kill something, even if you are a Buddhist. What he means by that is when you become a formal Buddhist and you take five vows, and one of the five vows is do not kill. So if you're a Buddhist, you know, that's the very easiest and beginning form of entering Buddhism in a formal way. And so do not kill. So that's what he means, is you should be ready to kill something, even if you're a Buddhist and you vowed to not kill. Whether it is good or bad, you should do that sometime. This is the yes, but. Yes, but even with Buddhism, everything has yes, but, every single thing. And here he's saying, even do not kill is yes, but. Whether it is good or bad, you should do that sometime. It is impossible to survive without killing anything. We cannot live depending just on our feelings. Our practice must be deeper than that. That is the strict side of our practice. And then he says, you know, yeah, this is the yes, but on the other hand, if it's absolutely necessary, if you feel that you can't kill that spider, then stop hitting the mokugyo and throw the whole zendo into confusion. That's also okay, if that's what you decide to do. So, and then he says, it's not so easy. It's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing to decide. You know, the person with the cockroaches, it's not easy. There isn't a simple answer.
So another one is, when you say there is no enlightenment outside of delusion, are you saying that our delusions aren't a barrier to enlightenment? Or is it possible that enlightenment is actually a delusion?
I think that when he says that, he didn't say that. That's just a truth, that there's no enlightenment outside of delusion because of the interconnectedness of all beings. And there's many beings in delusion. And so how can there be, if we're all interconnected, when Buddha was enlightened, all beings were enlightened right then. And so delusion and enlightenment are just other flip sides of the same coin, basically. I'm not sure if that answered your question, but that's kind of how it is. Flip sides of the same coin.
So, Gil, somebody shared, none of this seems to be a problem when I'm just doing it. But when I have to say something, oh, what do you do? Then I will say, oh, I'm a gardener. In that context, I guess it's just conversation. So then as conversation, it too is right. I still doesn't feel very good. I guess this is not exactly a question.
It doesn't feel good because you're labeling yourself, and labels are a category and you're not a category, you're you. But so when you do something without any feeling of having done something, then that is you yourself. In a social situation, when you say, oh, I'm a gardener, that's just you yourself saying something in a social situation. It's an entirely appropriate social situation thing to say. So there you are. You're doing when you do something without any feeling of having done something, that's you yourself. And that's self-respect. Don't forget that part. And that's self-respect. So you can have self-respect and say, oh, I'm a gardener, even though it is labeling and you don't feel so good about it. I think that's why social situations are awkward. You have to do things you don't feel so good about. That's my answer.
So another one is, to practice our way, we eat this food. Could you say more about this?
This is one of my favorite, I think about this line all the time. To practice our way, we eat this food. So we don't eat the food because, oh, I love, potatoes so much. We eat this food to practice our way. It's really different. It's a really different feeling. The Buddha was an ascetic for a very long time, actually, and hardly ate anything. And when he was collapsing, one day he was trying to get out of washing in the river and he couldn't pull himself out because he was too undernourished and weak. And a little girl had been sent by her mother to feed the forest gods, and she had this vessel of milk, and she offered some milk to the Buddha, and he took it. And he immediately felt better. And he actually asked for a second last cup too. And he saw that when he was nourished, he could accomplish more than he could when he was starving. And so it's not about the food. It's about, oh, now I can really practice I can really sit with all of my energy and attention because I have strength. So it's about the quality of our mind. Food brings us strength, and with strength, we have a better quality of mind, and we can practice our way. That's the order of things. And so when we chant to practice our way, we eat this food. I feel, I just love those lines. I just always think about them. That's all I can say.
Another one is, what did Roshi mean by, if I don't cut my life short, my students will not grow?
You know, Roshi came here to America. He was kind of fed up with Zen in Japan, which was just stale. And it had its way, and but it wasn't fresh. And he leapt at an opportunity to come to America. He just dropped everything and came. And he came to teach Dogen's way to receptive minds. And so when he found receptive minds, which he did, he very much did. He loved Americans because they were so eager to learn. He wanted to put all of his remaining life into that. So he didn't care if he cut his life short. He knew he was cutting his life short, but he wanted his students to grow. And it's part of why in the beginning of each talk, I make sure to say how honored I feel passing on his teachings, because I know that he gave his life to teach us Dogen's way. And I just feel so grateful that he did that, and so honored to be passing on what he gave his life up for. Thank you for asking that question.
Gil, another one is, I'm curious about the idea that Roshi might have had a premonition of dying when he said that Zen teachers in the Soto tradition often lecture on Sandokai toward the end of their lives. Do you think he did?
You know, this poem is chanted every single day in the Soto Zen tradition. I'm not giving you the poem itself. I will give you some verses, but it's very, it's hard. Roshi did need to explain everything. And so, but now that I've heard the explanation, I can give you something more easy. But this poem is chanted every single day. And I think, and the reason why is that it's like the truth itself. And so once you've kind of talked on this poem, there's not all that much more that you can talk about. And so I think that's why it usually happens close to the teacher's death. But I think more than that, Roshi's understanding, close to his death, I might have said this before, he pulled his close students around him and he said, don't worry about me at all. I know who I am. I know who I am. And who he was a part of the entire interconnected universe. And so he's just changing forms there's nothing to worry about. We're all changing forms all the time. That's what I have.
So another one is that we are all interconnected and interdependent physically, and in our actions make sense. But I have heard it said that thoughts are also interconnected and interdependent with everything. Is this true? If so, can you explain it a little?
The thoughts.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, I guess I don't really understand the question in the sense that thoughts are, you know, our mind is the most important part of us, really. And yes, it is definitely, according to Buddhist teachings, our mind is very much interconnected with everything else in the universe. All of us are. The minds of our plants are. I mean, when I missed my plants every day, and it's so much fun because I just feel them say, oh, thank you. Hi. I just, every single day, I feel that. And, you know, it's just my thoughts. I'm just saying, you know, you're so beautiful. I love you so much. Thank you for being here. And then I get back, you know, this, hi. And all I'm, you know, this is, I think it's all, I really feel the connection. And of course, and the mind is part of this as well, of course. I don't know what else to say.
So another one is, can you say a little more about freedom and strict rule are not two separate things?
Well, I think that the thing that saved my life was creating boundaries. And when I had the courage to start creating boundaries around my writing, for example, that was the beginning of my life. Like, oh, I don't let anybody talk to me before, you know, 10 o'clock because I'm writing. And so then, having set that boundary, then I have this all the freedom in the world to write. You know, if I get up at 4, I have 6 hours if I want to do without, to do my writing, which is, you know, something that I've chosen to do. So the boundary, I think that no is the freedom word, that in my vocabulary, saying no is the freedom word, because no is no, I'm not going to do X, Y, and Z. I'm going to do da, da, da. So that's kind of the way I metabolize that. That's what Roshi's saying about there's a strict rule behind everything. But so there's a strict boundary and there's a no behind all of the freedom that I've given myself for 50 years to do writing and Zen practice. And without that, it wouldn't have happened.
Thank you. It was powerful. So another question we have is, I have heard or read Roshi saying, when you are you, Zen is Zen. Could you say what you think this means?
I think this means whatever kind of bird flies through the sky doesn't care. That's what I think it means. When you are you, Zen is Zen. Whatever kind of bird flies through the sky doesn't care. So first, here's the trick though. First you have to know, oh, this is who I am. And then you have to have the strength to allow yourself to do it. And that includes having boundaries and being willing to say no. So it's not so easy in our complicated world. Whatever kind of bird flies through the sky doesn't care, but boy, you being your bird in our complicated world is not so easy. I understand. That's all. It was, there was a lot today. So I thank you very much for being here. Bye-bye.